Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Catherine Rundle is a literary prodigy and superstar. She's only 37, but already she's written an acclaimed biography of the poet John Donne, not to mention 10 children's books and one play. She's been compared to British fantasy writers like C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. And last year, she wrote a book called Impossible Creatures about centaurs and sphinxes and krakens and dragons. But we wanted to talk to her about the real creatures in another of her books called Vanishing Treasures. It's a collection of essays about endangered animals. And her favorite, or one of her favorites, is the pangolin, which she says in the essay is more beautiful than seems plausible in this fallen old world.
I have never fallen in love at first sight with any human being, but I have once in my life, and it was with a pangolin. To reach this particular pangolin was difficult, which felt only reasonable. Something so remarkable shouldn't be gained with ease. She lives in a wildlife conservation project outside Harare, Zimbabwe. The roads in Harare have been deteriorating for years. Gaps are patched with house bricks, and during the rains it would be possible to bathe a Great Dane in the potholes. Most of the road signs have long since gone. The rumour was that they were used for coffin handles during the cholera outbreak in 2008, although that's probably mostly apocryphal, and you drive by guesswork and hope. Hot pink and purple bougainvillea grow at the verge and occasionally overwhelm the traffic lights. You reach a wildlife conserve where there are two pangolins that are being protected day and night by their guards, men who follow them throughout the day, making sure that they are unmolested. They move from termite mound to termite mound. They need to eat an enormous amount. But the reason you fall in love is a pangolin looks ancient. And they are, in fact, prehistoric. They are 80 million years old, in contrast to our 6 million. They were here first, at the origin of things. They have an ancient, unassailable, ungainsayable right to remain. If you've never seen one, they look like an anteater. They are the sort of bluish green of the ocean on a cold day, and they have a tongue that is as long as their torsos that they keep furled up internally in a sort of pouch just in front of the hip. And they have the face of a kind of inquisitive, generous, polite academic. And the way they move, they walk on their hind legs and they sort of move their hands. If you were to anthropomorphize, you would definitely say either knitting or thinking about the chores you have to do that day. There is a real humanity to their faces. But they are also wild and strange. And I have never seen anything in my entire life so beautiful. The Sangu peoples of southwestern Tanzania heralded the arrival of a pangolin as a great event. It was said in the folklore that they fall from the sky sent by the ancestors and follow home the first person they meet in the bush. If a pangolin did arrive at a person's home, it was treated with both respect and careful wariness. With songs, a slaughtered sheep, the pangolin clad in a black gown, and a ceremony that ended in dancing. And they are also the most trafficked animal in the world. And so they are the thing that we owe our protection to and have failed to give it to. And, you know, the thing that haunts me is that we must take care not to lose them before we know them. They have a far more ancient right than we do to this earth. I I know so many scientists who have dedicated their formidable, breathtaking intellect to knowing the living world, and yet the thing they are most eager to point out to us is how little we know. What we know barely touches the edges of a percentage of the truth. And so, to think that we can safely discard any living thing because it's of no use to us, that in itself is mad. But even if you took out human self-interest entirely from the equation, the idea that there would be these creatures of infinite variety and infinite complexity, and we would think, just because we do not know, that they are expendable, that strikes me as one of the great stupidities of the world. We so rarely discover that we have overestimated the intelligence of something. We are almost always discovering that something is more complex, more strange, more vivid, more beautiful, more peculiar, more instinctive, more remarkable than we knew.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Catherine Rundle is with us. In her book, there are stories and meditations on lemurs and hermit crabs and elephants, bats, tunas, storks, many others. Rundle calls it a litany of creatures and the things we've always gotten wrong about them.
I guess the crucial misperception is that we think of all intelligence along the sort of measurement of human intelligence, and we have failed to understand that there are other forms of intelligence and other forms of knowledge. The way, you know, famously, the one everyone talks about is the octopus, that the octopus might have the same kind of, you know, profundity of intelligence as us, but just not comprehensible to us because in an entirely different sphere. But then also, when I say sort of a litany of mistakes, sometimes I mean also just the kind of the ways it reveals our very hopeful desires, that we hope that if we eat a specific kind of animal, maybe it will make us very good at sex, or that if we eat a specific kind of animal, it will keep us alive for vastly longer or give us vitality, things which almost never turn out to be true. I mean, you know, there's a list in the book of the things that we have thought are aphrodisiacs. The number of aphrodisiacs available to us in the natural world, which we could consume and would have that effect, zero. But we have suggested that, you know, beaver testicles might give you, you know, a fabulous level of profundity in your lovemaking. We often think, you know, tiger claws and rhino horn. Often because we tend to choose things when we're trying to imagine what might be aphrodisiacal, we tend to imagine things that are in some way connected to sexual organs, that look like sexual organs, like the oyster, or that are just very expensive.
I read this review of your work that identified what this person thought was a grand theme in your work, that she said, in the real world and in the imaginary world, because you write about both, there is this, as they put it, vital necessity for there to be wildness. Like, that is the grand theme in your work. Do you think that's right?
I think probably I have a sense deeply rooted in my bones. You know, if we cut people open, what would it be written? Probably mine would be the idea that our encroachments on the wild are one of the greatest losses that we will ever have committed, because the wild has its own truth and its own logic and its own beauty. And I think the other thing would be the idea of wonder. And I think often when we talk about wonder, it gets very twee, very fast, and it starts looking a little bit like sort of, you know, a picture of a sunset and someone reminding you to be in the moment. But like absolutely the opposite of that. Like the idea of wonder as a political active endeavor. You cannot be caught in wonder with a thing that you are familiar with. That would just be fake, pretending, striking a pose. the only way to remain astonished by the world is to learn something new. And this idea that we are required by the world in its infinite complexity to keep learning and learning and learning of it until our deathbeds, because that's the only way we can remain in the kind of astonishment which is the only reaction that something as beautiful and remarkable and bafflingly strange and other demands of us.
This, I think, kind of gets us to the work you've done on John Donne. Wasn't this sort of the idea of always learning, of incessant curiosity, wasn't that important in his life?
It was. It's one of the things I love most about him. He talked about his hydroptic, immoderate thirst of learning. And he had this idea that we are humanity. We are exhausting, pathetic, extremely stupid in many ways. And he says, you know, only man of all envenomed things doth work upon itself with inborn sting. We're the only ones out there destroying ourselves from within. But also, alongside that, we are the great miracle. And he says, you know, compared unto man, the world itself is dwarfed. You know, the idea that a single human soul is so colossal that it is larger than the world upon which it stands. He had this idea of us as, you know, a sort of miraculous chaos, an exquisite, nightmarish, extraordinary disaster. And I love this in him, his ability to hold this idea that we were in many ways the most faulty thing, but also capable of such passion, such focus, such attention. He loved a burning thought.
That review I read was actually for your recent book, Impossible Creatures. And I wanted to just ask you a bit about it, because I did want to talk about the connections between the mythical creatures there and the real ones in Vanishing Treasures. If you don't mind, can we just say something about Impossible Creatures? There are these hidden islands you write about, full of these mythical creatures, creatures that we know from ancient stories and myths, but they're very much alive in these islands. We say something about the idea here.
So I think I wanted Impossible Creatures, the idea that you could get to this archipelago, this enchanted archipelago where every creature of myth that mankind has ever invented is real. In many ways, it's a way to talk about some of the same ideas that Vanishing Treasures is about, because they are both saying, would you look at what there is and would you then fight for it? Because surely when you have seen it, if you have seen it truly and understood it truly, you will have to fight for it. And the book asks children to, you know, in some ways flex their astonishment muscle, to be thrilled. It asks the question in the book, as is often traditional in a fantasy novel, there are all these creatures of wonder, and it's both sphinxes and dragons, but also mythical creatures that we've by and large allowed to slip from popular consciousness, like carcadans and longmas and almirages and floods. And they're all dying. And the book asks, you know, what would you be willing to endure? What adventure would you go on to fight? In these enchanted islands, a few of our creatures have not survived. So they don't have panthers or giraffes or swifts. And so in the Sphinx says to the children, take care that they do not also become mythical. The idea, I guess, that I wanted to point towards, even if just very fleetingly, because I really very passionately believe that when you write for children, you do not offer them a story and then actually give them a moral. If you offer them a story, they need a story. So mostly, you know, I don't know how many children would realize. Mostly it's a, you know, adventure story with flying coats and baby griffins. But I wanted also to sort of hope that they might ask, would we not find the swift as extraordinary as a phoenix if you had never heard of it and if it was mythical? Like the idea of a bird that flies 2 million kilometers in its lifetime, which is enough to fly to the moon and back twice over, and then once more to the moon. Mm. Some of them have been recorded going more than a year, 2 years, without stopping. The swift is sky-suited like no other bird. Weighing less than a hen's egg, with wings like a scythe and a tail like a fork, it eats and sleeps on the wing. They gather nesting material only from what's in the air, which means that there have been accounts of still flapping butterflies wedged in among the leaves and twigs. They mate in brief mid-sky collisions, the only birds to do so. And to wash, they hunt down clouds and fly through gentle rain, slowly, wings outstretched. I feel like if you were to tell that to someone and say, guess, mythical or real, I feel there's a 50-50 chance.
I liked this question. Someone once asked you if you could have written this book, Vanishing Treasures, if you had been born in London. What do you think?
I have no idea what I said. I'm going to say now. I'm going to say, of course, because so much of Vanishing Treasures I have written from a position of ignorance. I have never seen a narwhal, and I expect never to see a coconut crab. I have seen a seahorse once only in my life. And so the way I begin these things is from a position of the things I long to know. I'm very lucky that because I have a fellowship at Oxford, many of my colleagues are scientists. And so I will begin with speaking to many scientists. I'll read a lot of monographs, a lot of really, you know, there's fantastic scholarly articles, and most of them are included in further reading in the book. But because the essays are quite short, usually around less than 2,000 words, I often want to have one story that will just, you know, grab you by the wrist, like the idea of, you know, the giraffe that walked into Paris and ate rose petals from the hand of King Charles X. Or, you know, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, who kept a wombat in his home and sometimes during dinner parties would try and lift this living and, you know, somewhat belligerent wombat into a great silver tureen in the center of the dinner table, which it didn't want to do. The idea that there's a seal that speaks English with a very strong Boston accent because it was taught to do so as a little pup. The idea of the ways that we have destroyed so much, but we have also adored so much. And I wanted to use that as well as a way of talking about the living world, because I think the thing we must never forget is we are the living world. Sometimes we draw a distinction and forget that we are nature. We are animals. We are an animal among many. And I wanted to write about how we, and as an animal, have, you know, imposed ourselves upon and tried to cherish living things.
Can we come back to the wombat? I loved this essay. Let's say a little bit more. You mentioned wombats. They're deceptive. They're tougher. They're braver. They're faster. They're quicker than they look.
Right. I mean, when we think of the wombat, we think of a sort of cheerful, rotund teddy figure. But a wombat, so the fastest recorded human foot speed is, of course, Usain Bolt. And that's a 100-meter sprint, which was, I think, 44.7 kilometers an hour. But that was just very brief. And, you know, he could only maintain that for 1.61 seconds. Yeah. A wombat over a bigger stretch could absolutely outrun him. So they are faster than us. And they have a thick layer of hardened skin along their rump, so that sometimes if they are, for instance, in a den and attacked by a fox, they can retreat into the fox and crush its skull against the sides of the den. So, you know, they have profoundly powerful behinds. And one of the things that everyone knows, of course, is that wombats are marsupials. And so the sort of embryonic joey, instead of popping out the top like a kangaroo baby, comes out between the mother's legs so that when it's digging, it doesn't fill the hole with dirt and suffocate the embryonic joey, which I just think is absolutely extraordinary. But also, as the book points out, it does make it look like the wombat is in labor for 8 months, which is why it was a kangaroo who got to be in Winnie the Pooh.
I guess the sad part of the story of the wombat is a familiar one. They were once seen as vermin or pests. They were slaughtered en masse. now they're having to contend with the destruction of their native habitat. So they sadly fit in that vanishing category, I guess.
They do. And so, you know, the criteria for conclusion in the book is there a species or subspecies which is endangered? And as you can imagine, that narrows it down almost not at all. Mm. And so while the common wombat is sort of, you know, their numbers are dropping, all species of wombat are now protected. There is a subspecies, which is the northern hairy-nosed wombat, which is an extraordinary wombat. It has a sort of softer fur, a thicker fur, and an enormous silky nose and poor eyesight. So it sniffs for food in the dark. And it's one of the rarest land mammals in the world. At the moment, we're not entirely sure of the numbers, but it's probably around 249, 251 left on the planet.
I want to come back to Dante Gabriel Rossetti, who had he was the painter you mentioned before. That's the story in this essay. He loved a lot of creatures. He had a kind of a menagerie in London. Wombats the most, though. I have to say, it sent me off Googling Rossetti and wombats. And there's this remarkable drawing of from Rossetti, I think, of a woman named Jane Morris, and it's in the British Museum, and there's a wombat, and each of them has a halo.
It's fantastic, isn't it? I do feel, if you are listening to this, please go and Google it, because they both have halos. They have identical expressions of rage. and he has just captured this moment that you know will never be likened again. And then, of course, the other thing about Rossetti is he had this exuberant passion for creatures, you know, but a very much of his time kind of attitude to them. So, you know, it was said that he tried to teach a toucan to ride a llama, and he wasn't great at allowing his wombats to thrive. One of them died probably by eating a box of cigars, and he drew a picture of himself with a handkerchief over his face, weeping, and underneath it there's a little poem. I never reared a young wombat to glad me with his pinhole eye, but when he was most sweet and fat and tailless, he was sure to die. Which is both sort of Victorian tragic and also a little bit of you feels like, well, I mean, mostly Rossetti, because you let him eat cigars. I mean, you know, there's some element of culpability in here, Dante Gabriel, but his way that he has immortalized those wombats is so worth seeing.
Catherine Rundle is a fellow at All Souls College, Oxford. We're talking about her book, Vanishing Treasures, A Bestiary of Extraordinary Endangered Creatures. I'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Catherine Rundle is with us. We're talking about her book, Vanishing Treasures. It's a collection of graceful, limpid essays on endangered animals like wombats and narwhals and hedgehogs and seahorses. We're talking about her bestiary of incredible creatures, not to mention the importance of wildness and how all of this might be able to provide a little perspective in times like this. The essay on the seahorse is great. As you say, seahorse is technically a fish, but then you write, so is a shark, and that doesn't tell you much.
Right. I mean, I've always been very insulted by the idea that the shark is a fish. I mean, I know it is, but it always just seemed confusing to me. Like tomatoes being fruit. I love the seahorse. They are another one. We are used to the beauty of the seahorse, the idea that there is something so exquisitely delicate that it looks like it must have been, you know, invented. The idea that evolution could create something so crystalline and perfect is extraordinary to us. You know, it looks like it was invented by the finest artist in the world. Mm. And if we weren't used to them, you know, we would, the fact of them, you know, that the male seahorse gives birth and they, in order for the female to be creating more eggs and therefore to have more births this season, they gestate for a very short period of time, 2 to 6 weeks. And then it's like a confetti cannon goes off. So the seahorse sort of, there are videos of it. They sort of look like they're sneezing, convulsing. And then from the top of his womb, there's 1,000 tiny, minute seahorse fry erupt. And he, you know, he disappears on a cloud of his own young. And then they do very little parenting because only 0.5% will actually make it into adulthood. But the female will immediately start making new eggs. And just, you know, it is an extraordinary thing. And then the way they dance. Each morning, the two meet in the male seahorse's territory. As they near each other, their colours change, out of subtle camouflage shades and into vivid hues, brown into white, white into yellow. The seahorse has tiny cells, chromatophores, embedded in the skin, each containing liquid pigment. By contracting or expanding the chromatophores, different colours appear with different intensity, orange, pink, red, a little like playing a colour organ. They circle each other, newly bright. The male twists around the female, their tails entwine. As they move, they click at each other, one of two noises of which they're capable. The other is a minute guttural growl when threatened, so faint as to be almost inaudible to human ears. Then the female returns to her own territory until the next day, when they dance again. For writers, hermit types, and part-time misanthropes, this might sound an ideal marriage. And then they are so delicate, and storms, as we get more of them, have started to erode their numbers. And of course, fishing is a huge threat to them, and their numbers are plummeting. But 12 are vulnerable, 2 are endangered. Numbers are dropping by nearly 3/4 in 10 years in some places. So, you know, my feeling about them is, if you never heard of them, if someone explained them to you for the first time, these dancing, colour-shifting, yes, technically fish, the only reasonable response would be, you know, to scream, to wake up and think about the seahorse and scream and then keep screaming until you went to bed and then wake up and do it again. And it's not practical, but it is what they deserve.
The section on raccoons, I think just their placement here may surprise some people who wouldn't think of a raccoon as being threatened or endangered. But let's talk about the raccoons. I'm guessing people around here in the Intermountain West of the United States would find them ordinary. So let's talk about what you find extraordinary. Maybe their paws, which hypersensitive, you write about that. That just the kind of incredible manual dexterity and their creative reasoning. Just convince us that they're not so ordinary raccoons.
So, of course, you have to remember, to an English person, I've never seen one. To me, they are completely extraordinary. But say you see one every day. Know that you are looking at something with remarkable intelligence. You know, they can fish food out of tins, they can push open windows. They have a whisker, a vibrissae, on the front of their claws and palm, and it becomes supple when it's wet. And so it becomes more hypersensitive, and that's why they like to dunk their food underwater to sort of read the food, essentially. The University of Wyoming did an ESOP test. So you're given a cylinder with a marshmallow floating on water that is too low to reach. And a human demonstrates that you drop pebbles into the water, which raises the level, and then you can snatch the marshmallow. 2 of the 8 raccoons successfully copied the human to raise the water level, you know, to Archimedes themselves, and snatch the marshmallow. Another one knocked it over, which I just think is absolutely extraordinary. And these are things that not all toddlers would be able to do. They can learn to pedal a bicycle. They can learn to sweep the floor with a broom if you're particularly in trying to train them to do so. So when you next see one, yes, they are knocking over your trash cans, and you should definitely try not to get bitten by one.
So I think the raccoons most of us around here are familiar with are fairly good sized and pretty vibrant. But you do write about the Barbados raccoon, petite and delicate and I guess no more. Will you say something about that finally?
Absolutely. So that was the other thing I wanted to include in this book, the idea of these things that we will not see again. The Barbados raccoon was one of the very fairest, had one of these sort of blonder tinges to its skin, and it was a subspecies, so its skull was more slender. Its fur was sort of yellowy white around the face. And neither you nor I nor any living person will ever see one because they are extinct. Their numbers were decimated by traffic and human incursion in Barbados. And the last known member of the Barbados raccoon family was hit by a car in 1964. And now we have only a few taxidermied species of them. You know, in 1996, they were officially declared extinct. And we won't find any more. And in some ways, it's a small loss, a subspecies of a single species. But I would say that something beautiful and intelligent that existed no longer exists. I would say that is bleak enough.
How do you make sense of the way we have treated wolves? This is an issue people in the West of the United States will understand. But of course, in Europe, it had the same kind of treatment of wolves. As you say in the book, we decided very early on that wolves were deceptive and ravenous and morally backward. Why? How do you understand that?
It's such an interesting thing, the power of human stories. We saw something that frightened us. And rightly, you know, there was a time when wolves ate our sheep and very occasionally our children. But really very rarely. And that was long, long ago. And the fear continued. And in many ways, once you have picked something and you have put it in every single story, the stories have their own power. And so, for instance, you can find these records of death in London called the Bill of Mortality. And because most of my work is on Renaissance England, I was reading these bills, and there are many, many causes of death, things like teeth eaten of lice, king's evil, blasted. But in 1650, 8 cases read wolf. And the first time I read this, I was imagining, you know, wolves prowling through the Globe Theatre. But in fact, of course, there were no wolves at that point. What there was a different word for cancer. We had become so attached to the idea of wolf as a ravenous thing that because cancer was a difficult word for many people to say, it carried its own thrill of horror. A lot of people called it wolf. Someone who had cancer of the leg said it is called the wolf because left to itself, 'twill not quit till has devoured them. And then fairy tale, the terminology becomes so strong that we then start using it as if it was real. So in 1599, the Book of Physics suggests that a cure for cancer might be to eat actual wolf tongue. You know, the strange way in which our metaphors can start to take real grip on our understanding.
Will you say something about the she-wolf that you once met?
Yes. So I went to meet this wolf because I was writing a children's book about wolves. And also I wanted to see the reality of them. And it was fascinating. I once met a half-tame she-wolf on the Welsh borders. She looked far less like a dog than I had imagined she would. She had humps of muscle under her skin that you don't see in dogs. It was hard to believe that she was the wild ancestor of all poodles and pugs. She had precision and control. She could pluck a single blackberry from a bush with her teeth. She smelled not at all like a dog, instead of dust and blood. Her fur, thick enough to allow her to sleep comfortably at minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, prickled with static when I touched her. She was very literally electric. She did not want to meet my eye. Wolves are like the fairy tales they prowl through, wild and not on anybody's side. A wolf is very, very unlikely to want to attack you. They are wild creatures, but they are no more keen to eat us than a leopard. It's just that we have written such fabulous stories about them, from Aesop to Little Red Riding Hood, that we have hung on to the idea that if you see one, the thing that they will long to do is eat you.
You have mentioned that when people ask what they can do, you sometimes go to the work of John Maynard Keynes, who said in 1930 that in 100 years, now not so far off, that technology will have displaced labor at that point. And what that could mean is that we'll have so much, you know, leisure time and so little need for money as a possession that we could be able to rid ourselves of our, as he said, sort of our ugly human qualities and really become a truly virtuous species. Say more about Keynes.
So I love him for this. As you say, he was predicting that it would be 2030, so we've got 6 years to bring this about. But his idea was that if technological advance made labor a much less crucial part of what it was to be a human, then money would cease to have its hold on us. You know, he says, imagine a world in which the love of money was seen as a semi-pathological, somewhat disgusting morbidity. And I think that is him showing vastly too much optimism about the human race. But I do think that there is something there we can hang on to, which is we will need, if we are not to burn the world to ashes, find a way to think about success and glamour and delight and joy that acknowledges that making a lot of money is not something to celebrate. It is not in itself a form of success. There's nothing particularly remarkable or particularly impressive about it. Many people have done it, and most of them have been semi-nightmares. What if instead, because of this moment of absolute on the edge of disaster, what if we could insist instead on something bolder, tougher, funnier, wittier, more just? It was what he was asking, whether it might be possible. And I think the secret is not to cease asking. It's the question we all ask ourselves over and over. What can we do? And I think, again, I think it's important to ask it every day.
Catherine Rundle, her book is called Vanishing Treasures, A Bestiary of Extraordinary Endangered Creatures. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Catherine Rundle. We're talking about her book, Vanishing Treasures. I don't want to overdo this, but I did want to ask, do you think an animal, or just the larger lives of endangered animals, can provide some kind of perspective at a time of uncertainty or anxiety? I mean, this is obviously a not so veiled question about the American political process. And I mean, even though we may want to keep this conversation completely separate from the sort of events of the moment, I think those listening are probably going to be looking for some perspective right about now. Can you offer anything right now?
I suppose there are two things I think. There is so much we could learn from the animal kingdom, but there are two things in particular. And one of them is there are many, many ways of living. I think often we are inclined to think that our own form of intelligence is the only form, but I think we could watch the animal world to see that there are other ways of understanding. there are other ways of knowing, and that human intelligence, formidable and glorious as I find it, has gaps that we could fill by spending more time studying the instincts and the cares, the ways in which the animal world will not exhaust the land on which they live. The animal world, it is only us who use vastly more resources than we can sustain. No other creature lives like that. And so I think that would be one thing. And I guess the other thing would be, if you are having a moment when you are crying out for something to do in the face, perhaps, of fear, what you could do is throw yourself into trying to protect that which needs your protection. People often ask me, who have children who are full of climate anxiety, what book can I give them to read? Should I give them this book that you've written? And I say, well, of course, give them this book that I've written. Marvelous. But the thing you can do if you want to help them not feel panicked and full of dread is help them to act. The way to deal with your dread is to act. And so if you find yourself looking at the living world and thinking it has never been more in danger than now, the thing you can do is act. Become even more politically active.
We were talking earlier about your book, Impossible Creatures, and that those mythical creatures in that archipelago. And one of the things you write about in that book is that these creatures all depend on this magic. Is it the glimmery?
Yes.
Yes. And I wondered about what is the modern equivalent of glimmery? What's happening in Impossible Creatures is it's diminishing, it's disappearing. But what's the corollary? Is there some other material thing like that magic that you think could be revived? Is there a connection there?
That's such a great question. Not one I've ever been asked. What is the glimmery? Glimmery is an old English and Scots word that I've stolen to mean a kind of magic. So in some senses, in the fantastical world of the story, it does literally mean magic. It's the thing that allows the unicorns and the sphinxes to thrive. But it is also, of course, in many ways pointing to the idea of a living earth, an earth that is able to continue to sustain us, trees that can still draw in carbon, a world that still functions as it has functioned for so many millions of years. But I guess also the glimmery, it's a magic that allows magic to keep going. That's what the magic does. It's the magic of sustaining. And so I suppose if it had a more human rather than natural world element, it would be the idea that there are many, many reasons to give up. And yet there are even more to keep going, even more to keep fighting. And I don't require that much hope. We often talk about the idea of where do we get our hope from? And I think, well, these days hope has to be a verb, it has to be an action, it has to be something you do rather than something you feel. And I think sustained, ongoing, iron-willed, furious, raging love for the world, that seems to me the thing that would keep us going. I'm not sure that hope does keep me going. I think the thing that keeps me going is quite an angry love for the living world and for, you know, the people on it. Nightmarish as we can be, we are nonetheless burning miracles. And I often think, you know, why am I writing children's books when I believe that we are in such a moment of real peril? And the only conclusion I can find for myself is that there is value in that kind of optimism. You know, Antonio Gramsci, in his Letters from Prison, he famously said, everyone knows it, you know, he said, I am a pessimist because of intellect, but an optimist because of will. And I think there is a kind of willed optimism in writing for children. I think it says, you know, we live in a world on fire. There are more flames to come. It is already baked into the system. but it will still be worth teaching children how to rejoice. And it will still be worth teaching children how to battle for the things they love. And it will never not be worth that. I think that would be my justification for what I do.
Could I have you tell one last story? You have an essay on humans in your book on Vanishing Treasures. And there's a story you tell about the Sibylline books. Do you mind telling that story finally?
I would love to. So this is a very old story. And it's a story that we loved it in England in the Victorian age. We used it for many of our morals. But it actually dates from, you can find it in Aulus Gellius in 177, in this era. And also in the late, great, great Douglas Adams's Last Chance to See. And it's based on the idea of a real, true happening. So the books are lost, but the tradition runs that in real life, an elderly Sibyl, a prophetess, in around the year 500 BCE, offered the last king of Rome the chance to buy 9 books containing, you know, all that was unknown in the world. And I tell it in a slightly, fictionalized and with some leeway given. But my version goes like this. So once upon a time, there was a great city and citizens leading busy lives. And into that city, one spring came an old woman. And with her, she had 9 books containing all the wisdom and knowledge, all the as yet unknown wonders and secrets of the world itself. And she said she would sell 9 books for the price of 1 large sack of gold. And the townsman said, well, that's ridiculous. That's an absolutely insane amount of money. In Aulus Gellius, he doesn't actually say a sack of gold. He says an exorbitant sum. And they say, take your books and leave. And she said, of course, as you wish. But first, she burns 3 of the books in the town square. And she, you know, goes on her way with the smoke of those secrets of the world as yet unknown still in the air. And it's a bad winter, and there's flooding and storms. But the citizens, they still thrive, more or less. And she comes back in the summer and they say, you know, how are you? How's the undiscovered secrets of the known world going? And she says, fine. And she'll sell them the 6 books, 2/3 of all the world's wisdom and delight. But the price is now higher. It's 2 sacks of gold. And the citizens say, well, that's completely outrageous. That's profiteering. Absolutely not. And so she says, fine, and she sends 3 more books up in flames. And the next winter is much harder, and it's colder, and there are more deaths than people can really easily bear. But, you know, spring comes and people try to forget. And so when she comes back with the 3 books and says that they can have them for 4 sacks of gold, the people are uneasy now, and they say, well, look, wait. Obviously, we can't give you 4 sacks of gold. That's insane. We don't have that. But leave the books and we'll maybe, you know, form a think tank or a committee and we'll let you know at some unspecified point in the future if there is something in them. But leave the books. And she says, can I have some firewood? And they say, we need the books. And she says, well, there is a price. And they say, we cannot pay it. So she burns 2 more of the books and leaves. And when she comes back, it's been a very bleak winter and the people are waiting for her. And they've done the math, they've worked out it doubles every time. So they have the 8 sacks. And as she comes up with the 1 book, they say, we're ready. And she says, the price now is 16 sacks of gold. And they say, but we have planned and costed for 8. And she says, 16, you don't understand, is cheap. It is gold beyond all gold, these books. And the citizens run away to their homes and they fight and argue and people fall out and families divide. But they bring the sacks of gold. They bring her the 16 sacks and they seize the final last book just as she is putting it onto the flames. And the woman says nothing. She loads up her sacks and she leaves the city. And they have this final book and they call after her. It had better be worth it. And she says, of course it is. Of course it is gold beyond all gold. It is the untold wonders of the world. It is the secrets and glories.
And she goes on, and then she turns at the gate and she says, "You should have seen what was burned." And I feel we're not quite at the final book, but our job, being alive now in this particular moment, none of us asked to be alive at this particular epoch, but here we are. And so our job is to fight, to keep as much as humanly possible from the flames.
Catherine Rundle, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Catherine Rundle, she's a fellow at All Souls College, Oxford. Her book is Vanishing Treasures, A Bestiary of Extraordinary Endangered Creatures. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we're on YouTube at KUER90.1 and Instagram at Radio West. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Stevie Shaughnessy, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.